Hey, if catching a ball game matters, this matters.
If a girl's night out matters, this matters.
If grilling out with family and friends matters, this matters.
If getting back to who and what you love matters, this shot matters. To learn more about the COVID-19 vaccine, go to vcuhealth.org/thisshotmatters.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Kevin McCullough. Great to be with you. This week, the former CDC director criticizes his colleagues for dismissing the lab leak theory on coronavirus.
I would never expect that from the scientific community.
We'll take a closer look.
We were not permitted to float ideas of what happened with COVID, how it started, how it got out. None of this was permissible to be discussed on our major social media platforms.
Vogue magazine publishes an article arguing that it's morally wrong to have a baby.
Having a baby is immoral, an act of pure environmental vandalism in 2021.
With arguments like these out there, I guess we shouldn't be surprised. Birth rates are down.
We're creating societies of a kind that have just never existed in human history.
We've got all this and more. I'm Kevin McCullough, your host, coming to you from my home station in New York City, where you can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on AM 570 The Mission and AM570TheMission.com. Take a moment to follow Christian Outlook on Twitter at TC Outlook and follow me on Parler and Instagram at KMC Radio. Great to be with you. We start in Wuhan, the capital city of Hubei province in China, and the point of origin of COVID-19 and the pandemic. On that, there is no debate. But did the virus enter into the population through the wet market, or was it released somehow through the Wuhan Institute of Virology? The hypothesis that it came from the institute was, until these past 2 weeks or so, dismissed out of hand. In fact, stories and discussion of the lab leak theory were being blocked by big tech social media companies. But the release of previously classified reports has given new credibility to the idea. Robert Redfield, the former CDC director, was never dismissive of the idea. He was critical of his colleagues in the scientific community in an interview on Fox News.
It just seemed like a lot of people wanted to squelch any idea that there was another hypothesis. And I think that's what I find the most disappointing, because I would expect that from politicians. I would expect that from governments. I would never expect that from the scientific community. And yet, what we witnessed was the scientific community went on heavy to try to stop any open debate about the origin of this virus. And I find that this very, very sad, very disconcerting, and very anti-science.
There's something disturbing about all of this. Why is it that elite media outlets are just now deciding to discuss? I turn to Carol Markowitz, a columnist for The New York Post and a regular guest on my program.
How should Americans interpret it when you have emails from Fauci and now the CDC director saying, oh, guess what? What we told you was probably the exact opposite of what's true.
Yeah. So, you know, there's always going to be things that we don't know, right? There's going to be information that's not made public and that we will find out later and we'll be surprised by it, or we won't be. But I think, like, the main thing that I want to, like, focus on about the lab leak is that we were not allowed to say that. We were not permitted to float ideas of what happened with COVID, how it started, how it got out. None of this was permissible to be discussed on our major social media platforms. That is downright scary now that it turns out that that was likely what happened. And I think, you know, there's so much more that we just don't know yet, and that we were not allowed to communicate with each other is, like, a giant, giant problem for what happened in the last 15 months and what is going to happen going forward, that we're limited to what we're allowed to discuss. And it's scary.
Well, think about this for a second. The era in which we were, you know, not allowed to do that came with a chief executive in office in the White House that was fighting for free speech at the time.
Yeah.
Like, this is how kind of insidious whatever this, you know, whatever you want to call it, the deep state, the bureaucracy, the, you know, progressive machine, whatever it is that's doing this. the control that they have exercised and that they have seemed to exercise, regardless of whether you had the most pro-American president in President Trump or the most pro-non-American president in office in Joe Biden in office at the same, you know, it didn't matter who was in office. This hand seems to operate independent of what the actual electoral process looks like.
Right. And I think a lot of it is because the left is so loud and powerful and controlling of these companies. I think they really have made corporations bend to their will. And the right and just moderate people are being pushed aside and not really allowed into the conversation at all. And it's scary to me that we've allowed it to get this far. And I think what we're going to be learning about what went down during this COVID period is just beginning right now. I mean, here's like one thing to think about. You know, now that the ex-CDC director says that the WHO was compromised. But if you look back at last spring, WHO was, first of all, their policies were what we were allowed to discuss. When they said that masking, and they said it quite late, that masking was necessary, that became the only, we were only allowed to push that one point of view. But also, the Hollywood celebrities came together for a concert last spring, and I thought, oh, well, they're going to, you know, be donating money to all the people waiting in food bank lines in America. But no, they raised millions of dollars for the World Health Organization. And then Google followed them and did a different fundraiser, again, for the World Health Organization. And all of that seems very questionable to me now, not in a conspiracy theory way, but in a we align with one position and we only follow orders from one area. It's, again, scary to me what would happen here.
There's no doubt about it. The pandemic has revealed a lot about what is going on in our nation. It has revealed the power of big tech and bias of elite media. It has revealed how polarized we have become. But it has also revealed how quickly we are throwing away the various pieces of a Christian worldview. Here's Albert Mohler from his briefing program.
Vogue magazine in England ran a very interesting article a matter of weeks ago. It's by Nell Frizzell. It's not often on the briefing we go to Vogue magazine, no matter where it's published, much less Vogue magazine in England. Why in this case? It is because the headline, quote, "Is having a baby in 2001 pure environmental vandalism?" Now, what we're looking at is an antinatalist worldview here, that is, a worldview against babies, or at least raising the question as to whether having a baby is an immoral rather than a moral act. The headline is stark in and of itself, but so is the article. But what's most important for us to recognize is that this isn't some kind of article that stands alone as making some kind of radical argument or raising a radical question that's not being raised elsewhere. The reason why I'm citing Vogue magazine from the United Kingdom is that this is actually appearing in a lifestyle magazine, an aspirational lifestyle magazine, as if to say the beautiful people thinking beautiful thoughts are now asking whether or not babies are immoral. Having a baby is immoral, an act of pure environmental vandalism in 2021. Now, Nell Frizzell, who wrote the article, by the way, came to the conclusion that, yes, it might be pure environmental vandalism, but she had a baby anyway, and she says that if her partner, that's the language used, were to agree, she might have another one. But clearly, she has a very troubled conscience about having a baby. And she's basically, in this article, defending the decision to have a baby as if the obvious default moral position would be against such. Frizzell asks, opening the article, quote, "Is having a child an act of environmental vandalism or an investment in the future? Is it possible," she asks, "to live an ecologically responsible life while adding yet another person to our overstretched planet? Can I get away with it if I just never learn to drive, never get a dog, and keep wearing the same three pairs of jeans for the rest of my life?" End quote. Now we need to step back and understand that in worldview analysis, the questions that a culture contemplates tell us a great deal about the culture. The questions that are tugging at a social conscience tell us a great deal about the society. In this case, raising the question as to whether it is actually, by default, morally wrong to have a baby, or even if it is now morally suspect to have a baby. That tells you that the entire logic of human civilization over all the millennia of human experience is being turned on its head, because in no previous generation of human beings, anywhere at any time, would you have had the issue raised as to whether having a baby is morally right or morally wrong. Just remind yourselves of the Christian worldview in the very opening chapter of Scripture, where we are told that God's first command to human beings is be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. You are looking at the fact that in our very strange postmodern times, you can have an article like this that might actually help to sell magazines. Because if this woman's asking this question, no doubt there are many other people, many other women asking this question as well. It's also interesting to see the terms in which the author frames the issue. Quote, for the scientifically engaged person, there are few questions more troubling when looking at the current climate emergency than that of having a baby. So notice humanity, at least in Western nations, is now being divided between those who are scientifically engaged and those who are scientifically disengaged. Evidently, one sign of being scientifically disengaged, according to this argument, is failing to see that deep moral crisis as to whether it is right or wrong, moral or immoral, to have a baby. The article then continues, in which she makes the clear statement that if a woman decides to have a baby or not, it is clear that, quote, the declining health of the planet cannot help but factor in your thinking, end quote. She goes on, quote, before I got pregnant, I worried feverishly about the strain on the Earth's resources that another Western child would add. Notice here the kind of Western guilt, the guilt of Western civilization that is being held up. As if having a child in the Western world is now even more morally suspect than having a baby elsewhere. She says that she worried about, quote, the food he ate, the nappies he wore, the electricity he would use before he'd even started sitting up. She says, my child would have already contributed far more to climate change than his counterpart in, say, Kerala or South Sudan. But I also worried about the sort of world that I would bring my child into, where we have perhaps just another 60 harvests left before our overworked soil gives out and we are running out of fresh water. Could I really have a baby knowing that by the time he was my father's age, he may be living on a dry and barren earth? End quote. That is a picture of an ecologically disastrous dystopia. Here we are told that the future of planet Earth might come down to another 60 harvests. So this tells us that according to this reckoning, that a child born in 2021 may be in a world marked by absolute famine by 2081. As we shall see, by the way, this is a massive logical fallacy. It's the fallacy of believing that current trends continue without any interruption, technological development, or any other kind of intervention. This is exactly the kind of logic, the kind of deadly logic that was exposed as being so false in the ecological crisis declared in the 1970s and in the 60s, the so-called population explosion. We were told in the 1960s, as we shall see, that the expanding planetary population would bring life to an absolute end with millions of people dying of starvation. It didn't happen. To the contrary, the world is now able to feed far more untold billions of people than would have been the case 50 years ago.
Coming up.
We're creating societies of a kind that have just never existed in human history.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. Given the sort of argument that we heard Albert Mohler describe in the last segment, it ought not be a surprise to us that couples are having fewer babies. We also know that we are becoming an increasingly secular nation, and those two things are directly related. Philip Jenkins is a professor at Baylor University. His latest book, Faith and Fertility, deals with the challenges related to our new demographic realities.
He joined John Hall and Kathy Emmons to discuss it from Word FM in Pittsburgh.
These are some shocking numbers that we're seeing. A dizzying reversal, this is what the New York Times says, unmatched in recorded history, not recent history, all of history.
Right. Normally, if a fertility rate is 2.1, that means the number of children that a woman will bear in her lifetime, and that means that society will just jog along with roughly the same population. Mm-hmm. If it goes way beyond that, then you get a contracting population and a much older society. And the world, much of the world is now heading to 1.7, 1.6, and that means aging countries and way, way more old people, because of, you know, medical science. So we're creating societies of a kind that have just never existed in human history. And, you know, you can't often say that seriously. And so what I try and do is look at some of the implications of that for different things. And one thing I'm interested in is religion.
Interesting. Okay, so, Philip, I think for a lot of families, maybe people who didn't go to church as singles, but then when people get married and then they have babies, people tend to go back to church as families. I mean, that's fair to say. So with the absence of all that, what will happen to the church? What do you foresee?
It'll be a very different church, for one thing. Raw numbers in many parts of the world, in Europe and North America, are going to be plunging. Low fertility rates correspond very closely with low faith societies that are very secularized. But what it also means is that the balance of the church or any religion shifts to those remaining societies that are high fertility, high faith, and that means societies like Africa, for example, which are still in that mold. So I imagine if you look at Europe, if you look at, say, the Catholic Church in 10, 20, 30 years, it'll become ever more an immigrant church, and particularly an African church. By 2050 or so, Africa will be by far the largest Catholic continent and the largest Christian continent. Largest Christian continent, it'll almost be there in Catholic. Something happened this year. There are now more Catholics in Africa than Europe, which is something that we didn't think would happen in for quite a while.
That's a shift as well. So, Philip, talk to us about how this could affect local churches. You talk in your article about how, you know, for many years there were, and many churches even today exist specifically for their youth programs. You're talking, though, about a shift in demographics such that there might be twice as many older people in a church than there are kids.
Well, twice as many older people than kids in the country as a whole, but in the churches themselves, I think you'll see a lot of churches and congregations, not just in the Christian world, Jewish world as well, where there are virtually no children, where the young families just are not there. And if you think about it, if you think of a congregation where the average age of the population is in the 70s, it's a very, very different kind of congregation from anything that existed beforehand. You know, you think of how much of the energy of the church goes into schools, Sunday school, vacation, Bible school, and so on, all those programs. Well, just suppose you take those out of the picture, not just in a couple of the old Protestant mainline denominations, but across the board in many, many Catholic churches as well. And interestingly, in terms of stereotypes, some of the fastest falling fertility rates now are among Latino people. So we're really seeing an across-the-board change, creating a society that, like I said, we've just never seen in history before.
So, Philip, what does that look like then? You know, so if the church is 80% old people and 20% people under the age of 60, I mean, that's a heck of a lot of work for those 20% of people.
It absolutely is. And what it means is what churches have to do is carefully do inventories of the kind of skills and abilities that they have. You know, a lot of those much older people, they might not be great in a lot of physical skills, but think of the experience and the expertise that they can offer. And so much of what churches do has to rethink in terms of old age. You know, you go into any like selection of religious books. You look on Amazon. So much of it is about younger people. Mm. How many books do you see that are directed to that much older crowd? Yes, indeed, there are some. But most of them, I find, are directed to preparing for death. Well, gee, I think there's a lot of other things that might be done there as well.
I hope so. Okay, so then you don't want to be, you know, a naysayer here. Of course, there is a silver lining, isn't there, in all this?
Well, there are different ones. For one thing, a society with a very low fertility rate tends to be much less turbulent. It tends to be much more stable, and that's all good. But there are drawbacks. So there are real advantages in some of these churches, as long as churches figure out that they are there and they go out and deal with them. And you know, the other thing is, if you have churches in a an area, some of which are this older profile and some of which are these much younger immigrant churches, it's interesting thinking what one might contribute to the other, as long as they realize they're in the same business. They're different departments of the same corporation.
Philip, let's talk about the lonely elderly. I mean, this is something that's been at the forefront of what we've read about in the COVID era. But now, if the numbers you're talking about are accurate, that's going to become a way of life for people. How can the church get ready for something like that?
Once again, first of all, recognizing the problem, and by the way, not just for older people. You know, if you look at population trends in the last 20, 30 years, you see a very rapid breakup of those nuclear families, extended families. Very large numbers of young adults live alone. They define their contacts by these networks and friends. And that's why the coronavirus has been such a general disaster. You know, I still think we'll be picking up the pieces of that forced isolation and separation for years to come. But, you know, like I say, the first thing is recognize the problem, acknowledge the problem, and churches, religious institutions, I think have got a huge range of options in terms of giving people things to do, giving people direct human contact.
Yeah. I mean, this is fascinating, Philip. I mean, to see what, you know, the next few decades will portend, it's just a very strange era that you're saying we'll have to walk into.
Absolutely. And but maybe one of the biggest traps to avoid is the idea that so much of this can be done by going remote, by going virtual, and we can do this all with, you know, there's an app for that. Well, maybe there is, but there isn't an app for direct face-to-face contact, which is qualitatively different from everything we've become used to. And I think, you know, I speak for many. When you think of the last year, I think we've realized the advantages and possibilities of that kind of remote access, but also the extreme limitations. You know, I'm very much looking forward to shaking somebody's hand again.
Coming up,
the left controls a lot of the institutions, if not all, the major institutions in America.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Kevin McCullough. If you are someone who is tracking with the news cycle and watching the trends we are seeing unfold before us, it seems like every day there's some new area under attack or something else we care about that is at risk. It does feel like a great unraveling. David Fiorazzo gets straight to the point in the title of his new book, Canceling Christianity, How the Left Silences Churches, Dismantles the Constitution, and Divides Our Culture. David was a guest of Lee Michaels on AM 980, The Mission, in Minneapolis.
We're not in the tribulation. This is, you know, I believe that the hour is near 100%. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be engaged in our culture and in our government.
Exactly. Well, we have lost a lot of it. I like to say the left controls a lot of the institutions, if not all, the major institutions in America. That means they have power, they have influence. What are we supposed to do as believers? We stopped engaging generally. And there's some people that have been fighting constantly. Give them credit. Kudos for those that are speaking out. But generally the church is kind of backed out of culture and we have not engaged. We've looked at, quote, political issues as something we don't want to be talking about.
Right.
When these are the things that are taking our country by storm and hijacking our country, just you can call it demonic, some of this legislation. And some of the word they're trying to change the language and redefine truth, redefine terms. It's just really absolutely absurdism is what it is, because it's moral relativism on steroids. But it's because we haven't engaged. And I always try to encourage people, you've got to try at least speak up. Ask people to defend their stance if they are on the left, if they're coming from the other side, that they're against the biblical worldview. I say ask them questions like, how did you come to that conclusion? Or when they say something about, you know, transgenderism, whatever it might be, just ask them, what do you mean by that? Because oftentimes they can't defend their position. Why? Because they've believed the lies. They've believed the talking points. They're the ones that have been deceived. And all of it, what you were saying, it's very prophetic where we're at now. There's a war on truth because there's a war on Jesus Christ. History, if you look at how we were founded, our founding fathers, think about how they would react if they could just be alive for like one day and look at the headlines. When you're talking about what's being taught in public schools, or you're talking about what the government is ramming down the people's throats, they would go, wow, this is totalitarian.
The schools were once, you know, local families getting together and hiring teachers. I mean, remember, we control the school boards, and we do need to be engaged in that. We do need to fight back. We do need to speak up.
I'm trying to look at this issue of education. So let me go back to a quote that I put in chapter one of the book. Calvin Coolidge said, "The strength of our country is the strength of its religious convictions. The foundations of our society and our government rest so much on the teachings of the Bible that it would be difficult to support them if faith in these teachings would cease to be practically universal in our country." Now you read these Barna worldview surveys and Pew and Gallup and Lifeway research, and you're going, wait a minute, only 6% of Americans have a biblical worldview? How did we get here? Let me go back to Harvard University real quick. Harvard University, John Harvard was a minister. He was a theologian. Yep. He started the university. The first, I believe, dozen graduates of Harvard were ministers. They were pastors. They had theological degrees. They were deep in theology, and they understood the Bible and Scripture. They could translate into Greek and things like that. Bring it back to around, I think it was in 1636, if I remember right, they came up with a motto, three words, truth for Christ and the church. It was a shield with three sections in it, truth for Christ and the church. In 1836, I believe it was, the 1800s, they removed Christ and the church. Let me ask you, if you remove the biblical worldview, remove Jesus, and remove the church, Jesus, literally his body, the salt and light on earth, if you remove that, whose truth are you trying to teach? And the word is veritas. If you look up Harvard's logo today, there's one word, veritas. And now you can register for at Harvard University as a freshman as one of, I don't know, 50 some gender possibilities, and they're all woke there. Well, what the heck happened? And it's not just Harvard, it's Yale, it's Oxford, it's all these Ivy League schools. Well, this is what happened. Our founders knew this, so that's part of the reasons they tried to pass some of the amendments they did, particularly the one on religious freedom. But that's something that is just gives you an idea of where we've fallen from.
Coming up,
the loss of traditional or natural limits and barriers was sold to us as liberation.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. In our nation and in our culture today, we've seen the advance of so many leftist values. Sexual freedom. Freedom to identify in the way that you choose. Freedom to marry or not marry as you choose. And I could go on. Sohrab Ahmari questions whether we're really that free at all. He's the editor for the opinion page at the New York Post and an immigrant from Iran, who's also an adult convert to Catholicism. Earlier this year, he published his book, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. He was a guest of Tim Gatos on AM 820 The Word in Seattle.
In order to guide my son, and then hopefully the reader as well, to this kind of deeper account of freedom and what it means to be truly free and happy, that is summed up under the rubric of tradition, I posed 12 questions. Each of them poke holes in one of our contemporary certainties, the things that we take for granted ideologically and don't even question, and we assume that these questions are all been answered, or that science or technology have superseded them so that it's no longer necessary to pose these questions. And some of the questions, and each question is paired up with one great thinker. So the idea is we work through the life of one great thinker so that it never hits the reader very thick with philosophy. You're reading a story of a person and you learn a lot about them along the way. And then the ideas are worked out through the drama of their life. And some of the characters are very predictable. And one of them is Andrea Dworkin, the kind of radical feminist in the 1980s and 90s. And the question that, her life seeks to answer in the book is sex private? And it comes down to exactly what you laid out. Because Dworkin, although she was on the kind of typical political spectrum, was on the very hard left, she has sensed and devoted her life to kind of exposing how the ideology of sexual liberation had paradoxically left us less free, and especially for women and children, had led to all sorts of degradation and the loss of human flourishing. On the one hand, we're told that every kind of sex is good, or nearly every kind. All you have to do is seek consent, and use the proper hygienic methods that going to prevent disease. So as long as you do that, it's a perfectly good private fun. On the other hand, we also see that, the project of sexual revolution has empowered, especially, we see this now with the Me Too movement, empowered truly caddish men who exploited women, and epitomized by, let's say, Jeffrey Epstein or Harvey Weinstein. And we can't reconcile the tension between the two. We're relational, rational beings, and we don't just want to hook up with whoever. We want to build relationship. And so it leaves us both sexes dissatisfied and unhappy. And yet we don't go back and question whether or not sexual liberation itself was a good idea, and why it was that older civilizations, they didn't ban sexuality, but they built guardrails around it because they understood that it was a powerful force, and that if it wasn't properly channeled, it would leave us less free. And the same thing with a homeless and addiction crisis. As you say, in all of these cases, we see this working out of a strange paradox, that the loss of traditional or natural limits and barriers was sold to us as liberation. Only with the loss of those barriers do we see that they actually kept us free. And that their loss leaves us confused, addicted, unhappy, and ultimately less free.
I guess the analogy, and I saw someone mention this the other day, they found a baby hippo and saved it and nurtured the baby hippo, fed it. When the baby hippo grew a little more, it ended up dragging the man into the river and eating him. And it was an analogy of what we're seeing in some of our politics today and in our society today, that some of the things that we're witnessing, some of it might seem good. And I see some really benefit in that. But if you give a little bit in some of these pretty radical ideas, are we going to end up just getting eaten? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even say radical ideas like, I don't know. I mean, I know the Pacific Northwest has had this scourge of old school political violence in the form of Antifa and so forth. I mean, that's a kind of extreme expression of it. But a more mundane expression that I explore through the book, but also beyond my book and in my kind of public journalism, is how we've become blind to the possibility of private tyranny. So that the little hippo that you're talking about, if I might borrow your analogy, might be private tyranny, which I'll define in a second. And it, as it grows up, we suddenly see, oh, wait, this could be a problem too. And what I mean by that is that, you know, American civilization has been, I would argue, since the founding, especially concerned with checking the possibility of public tyranny. So, in other words, we're very, very much worried about what government might do. And we've set up an entire system in many ways that is designed to make government in some ways, to tame government and to tame public tyranny, which is fine because public tyranny is a real concern. But the classical and Christian tradition was also very much always concerned with private tyranny, that is, the tyranny that is exerted by private actors, whoever that might be. It begins with the tyranny of the self, of the baser side of each of us that just is constantly seeking to be greedy or lustful and so forth. And so that in the older accounts of freedom, to be really free meant, first of all, that you've tamed and governed the interior tyrant, and that's what it meant to possess self-government. It also meant that you could resist external tyranny, but it began with the ability to resist your interior drive. And then we see also kind of the possibility of private tyranny popping up in our, I would argue, and this puts me at odds with a lot of my, I'm a man of the right, but I'm almost always lately at odds with much of the mainstream right, which I think is too blind to the possibility of corporate tyranny, commercial tyranny, right? So, for example, a lot of us on the right side of the aisle said, oh, great, like big tech, like companies developing these social media platforms that'll liberate us and allow us to communicate however we want, and it'll change the face of the earth and open discussion, when in fact it turned out that on the one hand, they have this kind of infinite scroll and all sorts of other mechanisms that are extremely addictive, especially with respect to children, and also that their overweening power that they've gained over traditional media and over the how we read and what we get to see and what we get to think has actually built up this kind of private tyranny, right? Like, big tech censorship has now become a huge concern for a lot of us.
Coming up,
the loss of the Sabbath was sold to us again as liberation.
More with Sarab Amari in the final segment of The Christian Outlook. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. America today is free from pretty much all the constraints of the Sabbath. Chick-fil-A, which remains closed on Sundays, is one of the few reminders of an earlier era. You can work on Sunday. You can do whatever you want on Sunday. But Sarab Amari asks, does that make you really free? Let's return for a few more minutes with Sarab as he discusses the unbroken thread with Tim Gatos.
An example of a similar kind that I use in the book is actually the loss of the American Sabbath. One of the questions in the unbroken thread is, why would God want you to take a day off? And I explore that through the life of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Hasidic figure, Hasidic intellectual from the mid-20th century. And he wrote very much about the Sabbath as a set of restrictions that are paradoxically liberating, how certain traditional restrictions, while they seem to limit you, in fact, are a source of freedom. And the Sabbath is just a perfect example of this, that, you know, in this country, we've had, going back to before the founding, before there was an American Republic in the colonial era, we had this tradition of Sabbatarianism, the idea that the law should uphold one day for worship and for rest. And it wasn't just for religious purposes in the sense that, you know, it's good for the citizenry to have one day to spend with the things of God, with scripture, with contemplation. It also had a temporal or secular aspect. And what that means is that there is it was good to give workers a break, a rest. And Rabbi Heschel talked about that in terms of, you know, honoring the realm of time,
most of our lives is spent in the realm of space. During the 6 days of the week, we compete, we're acquisitive, we have rivalries, we have geopolitical contests, and so on and so forth. And some of those are goods, and it's okay to pursue those goods. But there are other goods, such as contemplation, such as rest, which the concept of the Sabbath hallows. And so in the image of God's own celebration of creation, we set aside one day where we aren't acquisitive, we aren't competitive. And the loss of the Sabbath was sold to us, again, as liberation, right? It was, and it wasn't mom-and-pop shops that wanted to get rid of the Sunday blue laws. It was typically the a large kind of chamber of commerce businesses, and they were like, okay, well, now you get to choose. You get to shop however much you want. You can work on Sunday. Isn't that great? But in reality, it's meant that we live these very restless, harried lives. So in either case, both for the upper class and for the lower class, the loss of the Sabbath paradoxically proved to be a loss of liberation. The one non-contingent eternal being is God, and that's your ultimate refuge and a reminder once a week that, like, the things that stress you out, in fact, all of it will pass away one day. Mm. And that's just kind of the beauty of the Sabbath.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. You can catch the complete conversation on the Unbroken Thread at ChristianOutlook.com. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend and send them to ChristianOutlook.com to subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers David Poseidon, Mike Cook, and Nick Malone, I'm Calvin McCullough. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook. She expected the world.